Welcome to After the Deluge. I'm Justin Cox. My guest today is essentially our main character in this season of the podcast. It's Laura Jane Grace. Laura spoke to me from her home, fresh off tour, and the release of her new record, Hole in My Head, which is available now through Polyvinyl. I'll kick to that conversation in just a second, but first, a quick thank you to all of the guests I had on this season. They are Frank Turner, Austin Lucas, Ryan Page, Dan Bassini, and Andrew Valentine of Run Into the Ground, Keegan Bradford, Ben Lee, Christopher Norris, a.k.a. Steak Mountain, Casey Plett, RG Myers, Matt Helms, and Jordan Kleeman. If you're hearing this podcast for the first time right now, you should go back and check out some of those episodes. We've got one for every Against Me record. Find me, Justin, on most social media sites under the handle Routine Layup, putting in a pretty half-assed effort, but I'm there nonetheless. Here is a beautifully meandering conversation with Laura Jane Grace. Do you wanna scroll? Maybe what's the point? You just came back from a tour. How was it?
It was fantastic. Like really, really good. So much fun playing with everybody and like such a cool group of bands traveling together. And just like really good crowds, really good turnouts. It was a lot of fun. And we're all going out together again in May, and I'm really looking forward to it.
It seemed that way. I mean, obviously bands aren't typically going out and like trying to make it look like a drag, but something about the sort of bits and pieces I would see on social media just looked vibrant and fun. And then it seemed like as soon as you all got back, it was like, we can't wait to get out again.
Yeah. It's I've been doing like the solo touring thing for the past couple of years, which is like fun, but like I much prefer playing music with people, you know? Yeah. So to be up on stage with other people, like I've missed it so much. And like Mikey is a rad drummer, and yeah. Matt is just a fucking killer bass player. And like to be also up there with my wife, like singing together is like just a dream, you know? So it's just been like really cool. And to also then have like tickets sell well is like, you know, bonus. Like that's good. Cool too.
Hell yeah. All right. We're going to come back around to some of that more music stuff. I had a funny moment where I don't know if it was you posted it somewhere, but it was like something about along the lines of like when people ask me what a song means or whatever. So I was like, hey, Laura, no, this song.
You can ask me. If I'm ever giving an answer like that, I'm just still trying to honestly answer the question. I'm not trying to be combative or anything like that. But, it's funny because like in relation specifically, if we're talking about Against Me, like the earlier Against Me stuff that used to be a real like insecurity for me was that I would like write these songs and I would take a step back and look at them and be like, I have no fucking idea what I'm talking about in this song. You know, like I have no idea what this is about. So being then tasked to explain it, like I've gotten more focused over the years and I'm able to with certain songs like totally say what it's about, but like the older songs, you know, like I don't know what fucking Jordan's First Choice is about. What the fuck is that song about? Like what the
good
fuck, like We Laugh at Danger and Break All the Rules about? I don't fucking know.
Releasing feelings and you figure that out later. Did you watch the 7-hour Beatles thing over the pandemic?
I did. I thought it was fascinating. And it also like proved to me that all bands are the same. They're just exactly the same. And it's like the different personalities change from like sometimes it's the drummer that's like this or it's the bass player that's like that. But like all the archetypes are there. And that was what was really, truly fascinating about the Beatles documentary.
Yeah.
I look at that and I see my own band in it. You know, not that we're the fucking Beatles or, you know.
But so yeah. I think that's what was sort of beautiful about it. I mean, I remember thinking like, man, I like the Beatles and I don't know about a 7-hour documentary. And I was like 6 minutes into it and I was like, oh my fucking God, I just want to sit in this room forever.
Yeah, so well, it's funny too because like, you know, like there's that cliche of the like Yoko Ono, John Lennon thing, right?
Yeah.
But you watch that footage and I used to, when I first got into the Beatles, I loved John Lennon. Like, you know, my first full band performance was a cover of Imagine, right? You know, like, and he was always, I thought, the coolest Beatle. And like seeing that really helped flip me to being like, nah, it's Paul. Paul was the fucking cool one. Like, cause Paul just wanted to fucking write the songs. And, you know, like, Like, I think Yoko Ono's amazing and everything, but like the idea of being at one of those practices and someone, you know, like they're just like George Harrison brings in fucking two Hare Krishnas to sit there and chant True. While they're trying to practice. My God, I would have been furious at like.
Paul, yeah. Paul is just like, it looks like he's just shoving that boulder up a hill. Like, let's go. But this, to the song meaning thing, I remember, I mean, I know there's a lot of you, this whole idea you just described of like you write and the meaning is going to yield itself later or whatever. It's not like this song is about this and I shall write it. But when he's doing that, like scene, that's probably the most viral one, writing Get Back.
Yeah. But watching Get Back. He doesn't know what he's talking about. He's just like, oh, get back. Like it's
he's
not
singing boring, the early like iterations. He's talking about like Puerto Ricans and immigration and stuff like that.
He's just, and that's like, you know, like similarly, like I tried to do shit like that with like the song, like High Pressure Low, you know, like just picking out cool sounding like Vestal Virgins and shit like that, you know, like cool sounding phrases and stuff and stringing it together. Savages run, Vestal Virgins triumph over lifelong inhibitions.
Robert McNamara come out to you because the middle name is strange?
Well, I mean, there was, it's so musical, like, but, you know, I'd watched that documentary of his around that time. I forget what it was called. And it was just a fascinating documentary. And like
the Fog
all
of War.
The Fog of War. All those thoughts were just swarming in my head while I was on this cross country drive alone with like an 8-ball of cocaine, and I was just like writing songs in hotel rooms, and I'm like, yeah, Robert Strange McNamara, fucking like Vestal Virgins. I fucking read that in something, who knows, you know.
I told this in one of the interviews, but I once interviewed Robert McNamara's son about like his like sustainable walnut farming operation or something like that, and I hadn't seen Fog of War, and my editor, as I walked out, I worked for like a little local newspaper in a small town, she's like, don't ask him about his dad. And I was like, well, I don't know who his dad is. So now it's all I want to know. Yes, Robert Strange McNamara. There are those who just cannot forget. You have a New Year's resolution to not read horoscopes. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah. You know, and I've stuck to it. I haven't read, because I used to like literally for the past couple of years, I got into the habit of like, if I had have a big decision to make, I would literally look at horoscope.com and just see what it said for the daily horoscope of Scorpio. And it would like resonate like really strongly most times, which was like mind blowing for just such a like random generic website. But just pick that out as a New Year's resolution. I think in part to like kind of to just like have some self-confidence and like, you know, like to just to go more with your gut as opposed to like looking for that like, I don't know, some kind of assurance externally. That's my
I say it with no judgment to anybody, but you know how not alone you are in having looked, especially in the last few years, at a horoscope for answers, guidance, etc. You know?
Yeah, because the world is fucking insane and everyone's like going, what do we do? What do I fucking do?
Yeah.
To look to something else and have it tell you something, you know?
Yeah. No, I know. Like I listened to that the lead single on the Casey Musgraves album like starts with like My Saturn Has Returned, and I'm like, there's so many people who want to hear you say this right now. I don't know. I think in an age of like horoscopes will find their way into casual conversation more in the last few years than I've ever experienced in my whole life. And I think that maybe these things come down to like, again, I have my own fascination with the horoscope. It's like cool, fun. I can't claim to know a ton or like build my life on it or anything. I'm just going to keep saying no judgment, like I'm scared or something, but like it's probably the kind of thing people go to when it seems like there are no answers on the ground and in reality and in like the daily machinations of life.
Yeah, for sure. I kind of fucked up almost like a week or so into it, and I like didn't mean to, and I'm giving myself the pass because I was only being polite, where one of the bands I was on tour with over the run I did around New Year's Eve, like the one person in the band asked if I wanted a card reading. And I was just like being polite because they're like, you know, I'm on tour with them. And I'm like, yeah, sure. And then they like sat down and like told me my fortune basically. And I was like, fuck that. I feel like this counts as like a horoscope. And then they're just like, sure as shit, they told me some stuff that was like kind of negative, you know, where I was like, that's exactly why I didn't want this. You're telling me something negative that then's going to influence my thought, you know, like,
yeah.
So it's not even the good shit that horoscopes give. I don't want the negative stuff. I want to fucking not pay attention to that. And just like, you know, I don't know.
How's that gone in these months? Well,
there's been a couple moments where I've thought, damn, I wish I could look at my horoscope. Or I've thought, if I looked at my horoscope right now, it would tell me that today is shit, you know, or something like that.
Yeah. This has been a whirlwind kind of, you've had Married, put out a record, full tour, and then doing it again. Has this been a particularly, like, especially in light
of
that?
That's not even half of it. I'll tell you, let me fill in some of the gaps there. So it started out like in December where recorded a track with fucking Kathy from Bikini Kill, Lee from Sonic Youth, and JD from Patti Smith Group, and Paris as well, my wife, sang on it too. So, and then Jane County as well. We like covered a Jane County song for Red Hot. And so we started out doing that, did like this other track for like a Johnny Rodriguez tribute comp that'll be coming out later in December. Went down to Mississippi, my wife and I, and like this was right before we got married, and we recorded a 6-song EP with Matt and with Mikey as well at Matt's studio Dialback. Then we got married in Las Vegas. Then we spent Christmas in St. Louis, and then we bought a house together, and then got in a car accident. I got like sideswiped by a drunk driver in St. Louis. Then we went to Greece for a week.
Oh yeah.
And then also in there, like did a week and a half long tour, like around Denver, played in Denver for New Year's Eve. And then did the Joey Song Benefit, which was so fucking cool. It was like with people from Big Star and L7 and Soul Asylum, Silver Sun Pickups, Portugal of the Man, like Cheap Trick, like just the star-studded cast, all for fucking amazing cause. And then, yeah, that's all like only till February. It's been fucking wild, to say the least.
That's crazy. Do you get this month like some chill?
Yeah, you know, I do every other month parenting. So this is a parenting month then for me coming up. Have like the couple days to decompress and then get my kid back in like 2 days. And then I do like the school grind of like wake up in the morning, make them breakfast, get them off to school. And like I do work during the day of like, you know, sending emails related to like band stuff or whatever, or like we'll work on songs, or sometimes I do podcasts, you know, or whatever. And then I like to work out, right? I like to run or like go to the gym. So I do that pretty much every day. And then it's all just kind of like in preparation for when the next tour is, and with the next tour coming up pretty quick, like, and then a couple other things being in play, like, yeah. $1.50 and 8 beers at CBGB's. I don't know who you're with, but I know I'm not there. Sleeping baggled out on a backroom mattress, laid out on the floor, doom scrolling till dawn. In the faith, everything will be okay. If I draw the curtains tight and I sleep through the day, keeping the faith, everything will turn out great. If I could just keep my wheels steering straight.
Funny thing I did was like, I've listened to a lot of Against Me and the new record in the last like days leading up to this, but usually I'll listen in the morning right before to kind of go in. But I'd noted that you'd commented on Travis Barker and Rick Rubin like podcast episode. And so that's actually what I was listening to up till like the minute we jumped on this.
Isn't that the most you've like ever heard Travis Barker talk?
It's incredible. You're like,
so smart when he talks, actually. You know,
it's you have to really respect, like, damn, man, you're very articulate and smart and thoughtful.
Dedicated.
Yeah. And then have the restraint. The like part where the real major respect comes in is like the ability to know what band you're in and know that you have these two people there and not. He's like making a deliberate choice to not step on that with anything besides fucking crazy drumming.
Right. Yeah. And then, you know, what was also eye-opening to me too, was like, sometimes people I feel like would dog on him in the past for like, there's like that Nardwar interview where like him and Skinhead Rob look kind of like dopey or whatever. But then like listening to that interview, I'm like, oh yeah, you would probably just smoked like a dozen blunts and are all fucking like doped up on pills. And you got Nardwar coming and getting up in your face. Of course you're going to be a little like fucking disassociated, you know, I'd be exactly like that too. So I don't know. It was eye opening, and I think he's fantastic. Yeah,
I love when they're talking about, like, I think Rick Rubin's talking about like his hands, because he had this plane crash and he got burned and everything. And he's like, yeah, sometimes the skin is thinner and they'll bleed and blah blah whatever. And like Rick Rubin kind of asks him a couple times if he wears gloves ever, and you could tell he says no, and then eventually he's like, I don't like the way they look.
Yeah, they look stupid. You want to hear my fucking theory though? That, and maybe this will like jinx it, but whatever. I really think this is what's going to happen. I think there will be an Operation Ivy reunion, and I think Travis Barker will play drums for it.
Fucking A.
Mark my words. You're recording it here, so I just want to make sure that I'm the one predicting that, you know?
Documented. Aren't you doing something Operation Ivy related? Aren't you covering Operation?
In September, I'm playing a festival in Virginia with the band Cat Bite, and we're covering Energy, and I'm just going to sing and they'll learn all the music. And yeah, so it's like I got a little bit of homework to do, but also those songs are like ingrained in me. So I don't know. Shouldn't be too bad.
Hell yeah. Operation Ivy reuniting in some form for like a full set. That's got to be in like punk adjacent music. That's maybe them and Fugazi. Like, what would be the biggest deal imaginable?
Well, yeah, but see, the Fugazi thing isn't even like, you can't even talk about it, because it would actually be lame if Fugazi did it. Because, right, you know, right, like right. It'd be a for the money thing, and the, like, whatever, like play, make the play and get paid, you know, like that.
Yeah.
But like for Fugazi, like you don't want that to happen.
That's a good point.
But Operation Ivy are the only band I can think about that could still get together that would mean something, and that have like an actual like they kind of spanned genres in a way of like, I remember in the 90s, like that was the CD that like everyone had, like the skater kids had, the punk kids had, the random jock kids would have it too. So I feel like that would, it's like the one punk band that could still really draw and like really fucking headline festivals.
I always had this thing, like, you know, like, first of all, I think you're right. I know I'd go fucking crazy for that, but there was like a meme or whatever that would go around in like the 2000s or whenever, that was like, the tallest basketball player in the world is Chinese. The best golfer in the world is black. The best rapper in the world is white. And it would be like Eminem or whatever. It was all these sort of like, isn't this weird, in like a very, I think it might've been a Chris Rock joke or some shit. But I always thought about Operation Ivy as like, the coolest band in the world is a ska band, basically. Like, how are they that cool? They're, at the end of the day, they're a ska band.
Were that cool. And part of it is that that record actually kind of sounds like shit. Like, the guitar tone is terrible objectively, but it's also rad. I don't know.
You pay real attention to, I've like, in like reading some stuff from your old records and stuff, you've had like thoughts about obviously the drums on Axl Rose and the tone of that 12 inch we were talking. I mean, that's not even tone, that just is like,
but that was a mistake. Yeah, that was a total fuck up. Jordan just thought it was meant to sound like that, and it was just a bad cassette tape, you know?
Yeah.
Not that it sounded good without that on there, you know, like without the mistake. It still sounded like a 4-track recording, but yeah. I want to know about stuff like that. And that was like, you know, when you first go into a recording studio, that's what's so intimidating about it, is that, you know, there's all those pieces of rack equipment and all these microphones, and like, you know how records sound that you've listened to and you like. Like, I know how the Operation Ivy record sounds, like how it sounded going into a studio, but I had no idea why it sounded like that. And the first time you go into a studio, it's like, you know, reinventing Axl Rose is recorded in like 48 hours, you know, like there's no time to really learn. So it was like each subsequent time you're in the studio and you're sitting there, and oftentimes, like, especially when it becomes recording where stuff's recorded individually, like the drums tracked first, then the bass, then the guitars, then the vocals. And there's so much time where you're sitting there in the studio, like, I just thought it behooved you to like pay attention and learn, you know, and know what's going on.
You're like a guitar person, right? You're like a collector of guitars.
Yeah. I mean, I'll show you. I'm like sitting here.
Yeah.
with a stack of guitars behind me. I have like an actual storage issue of we just moved into a house and like I don't have enough places to put guitars in my closets in the basements, and I have like a lockout practice space downtown that's full of guitars too, and then some in St. Louis, and yeah, too many guitars.
There are worse problem, worse things to collect. I at some point I read that you like you had, I'm going back to some Against Me Records real quick, about Eternal Cowboys, this moment where you're listening to like Replacements and stuff and record at the same studio and all of that. And maybe prior to that, it's like a lot of this like Crass and a bunch of different stuff. But as you continued past like those bands that influenced those records, do you remember what you were like, what was kind of guiding you and you were listening to as you got through to like Former Clarity and into New Wave and stuff like that?
Well, like Former Clarity for sure, you know, like that record was really influenced by the Ugly Organ Cursive, and it was also really, really, really influenced by And You'll Know Us by the Trail of Dead, Worlds Apart. You know, like cool. Both those songs were like concept records that were like highly critical of the music industry and like had that kind of lyrical element to it, which already appealed to me because like that was what a lot of peace punk bands did that I like, it would always resonate with me, like like even the Clash did that, you know. But was listening to a lot of that at the time, but also like listening to The Streets, like the UK hip hop band. Yeah. Like if you the song How Low, the vocal cadence to the lyrics was actually written to the drum beat of that Fit But You Know It song.
That's like, oh shit.
And it'd be like, now I wake up around 4 or 5, shower and get dressed in about an hour's time. You can totally sing the lyrics along to that song. And then it just flipped it into like a country kind of Western song, you know?
I'm going to say, yeah, I can't wait to pull little clips of both those tracks in and try and go into like Ableton mashup mode with them.
See, I reckon you're about an 8 or a 9. Maybe even 9.5 in 4 beers time. That blue top shop top you've got on is nice. Bit too much fake tan though, but yeah, you score high. But there's just one little thing that's really, 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 really annoying me about you, you see. Yeah, yeah, like I said, you are really fit. But my gosh, don't you just know.
Seriously, this is my last stand, final time. Well, I'm making some big, big changes in my life.
And then the Weaker Thens as well, was listening to a lot of the Weaker Thens, and also we loved the Constantines. We were listening to a lot of the Constantines, the Canadian band. Those are things that I really remember, like us listening to a lot of, and we were listening to a lot of Lucero too, like and a lot of the bands that we were touring with at the time, you know.
It weirdly makes sense you saying all of those different things, which you covered a lot of ground there. But that record covers a lot of ground too. You know, that record isn't like, oh, that record sounds like this. It kind of sounds like 7 different things.
We were just, I mean, I would always do that of like, we'd tour with a band and I'd be like, oh, they're so cool. I want a song like theirs. You know, like Miami is totally a tribute to World Inferno Friendship Society. I just wanted to write a song that sounded like World Inferno, you know, like even the horn parts in the bridge or whatever. Yeah. So like I can look at a lot of those songs and see like direct correlations to other bands that we were touring with or listening to at the time, for sure. Just wanting to do something like them, you know.
When Miami starts and it kind of does a little ringy feedback stuff for like 40 something seconds, which is like half the length of a song on the previous record. Is that gesturing at like, hey, this is going to be bigger and more sprawling? Or is it just a thing you do to start a record? Or is it a little bit like, we're not just spazzing through 11 songs this time?
Well, we definitely were conscious of that. Like we realized that As the Eternal Cowboy was too short, you know, like, cause we even had to like stretch this length of time in between the songs by like seconds just to get it to like 25 minutes, I think it was, you know? So we were conscious of that and wanted to write fuller songs. And that was also like, you know, that was the difference too. And something that I really had to overcome was like, at first, like, I didn't know how I was writing songs. It would just happen sometimes when I was drinking, you know, like, or whatever. Yeah. Like, and then when it became like, there's pressure, you got to write songs because now you got a record deal or whatever. Like I had to figure out how to do it. And with Searching for a Form of Clarity, that was like really trying to focus on how do you write songs. And with that record, we were trying to do it as a band, but it did not work. We just did not write well together. And then with New Wave, I just totally took over. And I was like, I can't be in this frustrating practice rooms with you all doing the thing we just did with that record, because it was terrible and we all know that. So I'm just going to write the songs and then we'll learn them together once they're written. And that was that album. Yeah.
Dang, cool. And yeah, what were you on Tanny influences at that point? You're obviously, it's like Butch Vig and major record deal and more time and more resources and stuff.
Yeah, it was swinging for the fences for sure, while also still being like, you know, dealing with punk guilt and feeling inhibited because of it. But like, you know, Thrash Unreal, I've talked about, where Butch specifically was like, I want you to write a song that's like Walk on the Wild Side and Rebel Rebel. So, you know, the doot doot doo doos are the bop bop bops, right? Trying to think other stuff, like song like Stop with that kind of like disco drum beat was like not pandering, but kind of pandering to bands that were popular at that time, but bands that I loved, you know, like whether that's Franz Ferdinand or whatever, but like there was that real element in indie rock happening. And because we felt ostracized by the punk scene, we were trying to figure out, well, where do we belong? You know, like, do we belong in the indie rock scene? Because that's how we wanted to be viewed, was more arty, you know, like, then just, we didn't want to be viewed then as drifting into the mainstream douchebag rock scene, you know? So
y'all were navigating such a tenuous path this whole entire time. It just, it's like kind of a can't win, but you, I don't know, it yielded. I love that you're hearing, like you just said, you're hearing kind of journaled frustrations with everything on those records, and they feel real and alive and cool.
I think, you know, the manager that we had at the time, who we ended up going through a bitter lawsuit with, it was terrible, after New Wave was released. But, you know, I think they were actually accurate. They criticized me one time with the lyrics on New Wave, where they were like, they said something to the effect that I should have gone for themes that were more universal as opposed to focusing in on the record label minutia. And I think ultimately that they were right. I think that like I should have done that with Searching for a Form of Clarity and moved on somehow mentally with that. But at the same time, because we were so isolated, like we were alienated from all our friends back home, and we were spending like 10 months out of the year on tour. Like all I thought about was the music industry. So I didn't know, I didn't have any other life. So that's all I thought about.
That's an easy thing for that person to say. And it's an easy thing for you to say in retrospect, maybe we should have, but I mean, what? That's just a, you shouldn't have done this. You should do this instead. But if whatever your experience is, I don't know. There's an interview with, I love Counting Crows, and there's an interview with Duritz from Counting Crows where someone's like, you're mentioning too many specific things and proper nouns. It should be a little more broad. Or it's like, that's the whole fucking point of the way that person writes. Like, what do you mean?
Sure. I guess it's just like, I guess, yeah, like ultimately, like I do like the way I write, but it, like, you can tell when I'm not in a good place mentally because of it, like what I'm focusing on, you know? And I think then if I look at it, I'm like, you needed a hobby. You needed some shit going on besides just being in a band, you know?
you can hear it. You've recorded with both, Butch Vig and Steve Albini. Do you have a Nirvana album that you like over the other?
It's Nevermind. Nice. Nevermind is the greatest. You know, like anyone who says different is just trying to look cool. But yeah, Nevermind is like blew my fucking teenage mind, you know, when I was a kid. And like to make records with Butch was like the most incredible experience of my career. And like I honor and cherish that fucking relationship so much. And the things that I was able, like that he taught me, that I learned from him. But it was interesting, like, you know, I was almost really apprehensive at first of the idea of working with Steve, because I was like, I don't want to disrespect Butch by making a record with Steve Albini. But then, like, you know, but then I was like, Butch wouldn't give a shit. And then also, like, you know, the pandemic happened, and literally his studio was like right down the street from me. So it seemed like an opportunity. And I love his personality. But comparing the two experiences, it was so like a full circle, you know, of like, I'm so glad that I had the two experiences to understand them fully. One is like, you know, like you have to learn to see the forest through the trees, you know, and then the other experience is like, there is no forest. There are no, just like, I don't know.
You ever see that movie? You ever see that movie, I Heart Huckabees?
Yes, exactly. It was like that. Yeah, like the two opposing philosophers of like, what if it was like this? No, it's like this. They're all interconnected. You know, like it felt like Butch and Steve were like that in my head, like with their approach, because Butch is all about like, you know, there would be days where I would play fucking three chords over and over and over again while him and Billy Bush, the engineer, just switched out guitar pedals and tried dialing in the guitar pedals. And they were like, what about that? What about that? You know, and they're just different fucking overdrive pedals. Days like, that we would do that. Whereas with Steve, you know, if I did more than two takes, he was so fucking annoyed and over it, I could tell. And sometimes it was like, yo, I haven't even dialed in the monitor mix. Like, I can't hear. I'm just turning the knobs to try to like check my vocal. I didn't, that wasn't a take.
Oh my God. I think it's a gift that we got Nirvana run through both of those philosophies. That's cool.
Yeah, I almost want to make a record with what's their name who did Bleach, Jack and Dino, I think to complete the trifecta. But you know, like in a similar way to like I've had certain anchor points with Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers of like my first guitar was Traveling Wilburys guitar and I didn't know who the fuck they were. My dad just gave them to me and like I ended up moving to Gainesville, you know, like similar things like that. Like with Nirvana, I've like become a Nirvana-phile in that way of like, you know, like worked with Butch, wanted to work with Steve, worked with Steve, used to be managed by Danny Goldberg, who was Nirvana's manager and like, you know, famously like Francis Bean's like godfather. And then like, toured for 3 months with the Foo Fighters. Like, so I've had experiences with so many people that were in their circle that I don't know. Yeah.
Those are good. They're really apt like associations though for Against Me and you, like Tom Petty and Nirvana are like, this is at its core, pretty catchy music, but always like some band there's some coolness about them. I don't really know how to articulate it, but Tom Petty, especially like the part where trying to think about Tom Petty being from Gainesville and then Against Me coming out through Gainesville's.
Yeah. And you know, like all that's coincidence, you know, like my parents divorced, moved to South Florida, like already years before that, my first CD was Full Moon Fever when I was 10 years old. I lived in fucking Italy at the time, you know, like how the fuck did I know that I would end up in Gainesville, Florida?
Yeah.
And then, you know, the amp that I've recorded every record with since reinventing Axl Rose, I bought off of Stan Lynch, who was the drummer from the Heartbreakers. Like right in front of me in one of these road cases is a 64 Jaguar that I bought from Stan Lynch that I used to record Bought to Rot. He was fucking selling his Vistalite he used to record American Girl at one point for like $10,000. This was maybe in 2003, 2004. And $10,000 was like more money than I could dream of then. But now I'm like, it was only $10,000. Holy fuck. You know, like for that kit that recorded American Girl, if I could only have bought it.
Goddamn. Back in Gainesville, like, I feel like there's like people talk about, you probably hear this, but like, and I know it like trickled to me, but like, oh, Against Me, this band playing in laundromats, as if like every gig was in a laundromat or something.
And then, one.
Yes, exactly. One. Yeah. I think you clarify that in the book. And then it sounds like maybe there was like a bookstore or like kind of like gathering
the
place.
The CMC, which was like, you know, that was my first introduction to Gainesville. The first time I went to Gainesville, my mom and my stepdad took me and Dustin, who was Against Me's first bass player, to tour the college towns in Florida because they wanted us to go to college, right? So they took us to Tallahassee. Tallahassee sucked. They took us to Gainesville and we were like, oh, this is cool. And the first place I wandered into was the CMC, which is a volunteer-run, non-corporate press, library, activist space. And they would do shows. And when I first moved to Gainesville, I was only 19 years old, so I couldn't go to any of the bars and I couldn't go to any of the shows happening at bars. I could go to house shows or I could go to the shows at the CMC. And I moved to Gainesville because of the activism, really, primarily. Like there was just a group of kids from Southeast Florida. They were all anarchists and all like involved in the activism world that I wanted to be a part of. And they gravitated and circled around the CMC. And so that was like where Against Me existed. And we were outcast because of it, because all the real bands, quote unquote, in Gainesville played at the real clubs, you know, and like they were on No Idea Records, whereas I'm dubbing cassette tapes that sound like shit, like 12 inch EP, You know, like, and I remember the first time we recorded with Rob McGregor was Crime. And I remember a couple of the like luminaries in the punk scene then that I really looked up to and admired came up to me and they were like, you know, that recording sounds really good. I get it now. And I was like, fuck yes. Like it like meant so much to me.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, they're right. I think there's something beautiful in those, like that little moment of like, you're not just putting your stuff on some tape and having it hopefully sound okay, but likely sound like shit. And you're not yet like swapping out pedals for a day and a half and making it sound exactly like you want. There's like some limitation and constraint, and always, I'm sure you have bands and artists you like that little sweet spot period is always going to be special.
Right. And then the other element of that combination is like, you know, with your first record, you have all the time in the world to write it. Right. You know, like, so all those songs had been brewing and brewing and brewing, you know, so you get that combination of like naivete
yep.
and inexperience with ambition and actual hard work put into it. And that's when you get like good results.
I just like gems. I've been drinking Irish tonight, but I'm making up this eyes wide right.
Your book, Tranny, is like heavy on journal entries. Are you still, do you still journal with like a lot of frequency? Like, where does that fit into your life? How do you?
Every day, every morning. I like try to do the like morning pages routine, you know, of like write 3 pages, don't think about what you're writing, don't read it again, just to start the day. And like, I was really motivated with journaling and to continue doing that stuff just because I wanted to be a better lyricist and I could only actually spend so much time each day writing lyrics. But yeah, I have like, I'm once again at a point where I kind of have a gigantic foot locker just full of fucking journals. And I'm looking at it like, I need to do something with this just so I can burn all these and move on.
Nice. Are you ever, while you're doing these morning pages and journaling, there were parts in those other, in those journal entries in the book where you're like, holy fuck, I think that becomes a lyric, not with like a ton of frequency, but you see some of it. I know that the purpose of that is to do it with no point whatsoever besides like, let things come out of the mind. Does it connect in any kind of active way with the process of like active songwriting? Maybe this will yield ideas.
I cheat a little bit where if I like write something where I'm like, that's a good line, I'll like underline it so I can skim back and like fucking take the line. Yeah, I cheat a little bit. But you know, I find that like a lot of the time now, most of my lyrics come to me when I'm working out. And it's really like when I go on a run, you know, like, and I reach that point where I'm like, only focusing on how bad my body hurts and how much it hurts to breathe, that then I stop thinking about whatever's stressing me out and then a lyric will come to me. Yeah. And then I'm like that idiot running down the street trying to type it into their notes in their fucking iPhone. Then I get home and I write it into my notebook, you know?
Some of that stuff, I have like little moments like that in life too, where in reality, what I call like I got an injury a couple years ago and I started doing like yoga with Adrian on like YouTube or whatever.
Yeah, Benji.
love it. Absolutely love it. What I realized while I was doing that for like, say, 20 to 40 minutes at a time was like, I think this process is like having me think of all the things I'm not thinking about through my day. And suddenly, like, do I put a little to note thing to note the thoughts that are coming to me? I think in part, it's like the active process, the running, the exercising, the whatever. But then the other part is probably just that I'm like spending more than 7 minutes not looking at my phone, probably. Mm-hmm. It's probably as simple as like a little bit of brain space, you know?
It's good for you.
It is, yeah. What's it like working, collaborating on a project with Steak Mountain?
We have like such a unique relationship in that the first thing we did together was that 7-inch that he did for the outtakes from As the Eternal Cowboy with the art of the gingerbread man exploding out.
I saw it in real life the other day at my friend Jay's house. It was cool.
My favorite thing I've ever done. But, you know, that was Var's idea to have him do that. So Var made that connection and then we connected and started working directly with each other. Initially just on shirts. Like I didn't at first release to him the artwork for the covers until White Crosses, and he was already doing shirts for us. It's Searching for a Form of Clarity Point, right? But he did like the live album and like some of the EPs and remixes. But we always had like a really prolific pen pal relationship where we would just write epic long emails about movies we'd like,
liked or records we liked or just shit talking people. But then only ever really hung out in person a couple times, you know, and this has been our relationship for decades. But Chris is like notoriously cantankerous, where he like will tell you like, I hate people. I hate your fans. I hate your fucking shows. And I'm like, never really sure he likes the music even, you know, like, I don't think he does.
Like, I think you might be right. Music.
I think he has respect for me that I put work into it and that he can respect that. But like, he likes what he likes and it's very particular. And sometimes we'll butt heads on shit or whatever, but it's always been like that, you know, like it's just been an epic long, like pen pal relationship. And we work really well together because I can directly tell him like, this is my idea, and he can show me shit that he's been thinking, and he doesn't take stuff personally, and nor do I.
Yeah, that's a unique fella, funny guy to talk to about. I think he basically said at one point, like, he kind of just doesn't like music.
Yeah, you know, like, he just doesn't, he definitely doesn't like anything that's popular.
Yeah.
You know, like, and that's it. And but I get that too, you know, like, he doesn't like crowds of people. He doesn't like groupthink, you know, like, nor do I. Like,
yeah, you know, it's a beautiful thing. Well, it's funny, is like, he then simultaneously says like he liked White Crosses, and I think there's a certain level of like the band with like intention and no, they're not hiding the fact that they're trying to make some big catchy pop rock songs basically, and there's an honesty and like, this is what we're fucking doing. That's it.
Right. And that's what it is. It's the honesty that he respects. But I also think that like he has that thing too of like, when you get a little distance from it, he's able to, when he's not being told he needs to like it, then he can like it. And I get that. Yeah.
So I love, the new record is great. And I love, I think Birds Talk 2. Do you remember the moment that riff came to be, that little chord progression riff, or how that came?
It was instantly. Like, so I've spent like the past decade getting tattooed by two Japanese tattoo artists who, when I met them, they were doing a residency or guest spot here in Chicago, went to Japan a number of times, got tattooed by them a bunch of other places. Eventually they moved to Amsterdam. So like, literally started on my feet, worked their way all the way up my body. And I'd always said to Gakin, the one, like, I was like, I want you to tattoo my head at the end. I want you to tattoo my head. So it was a crazy like experience with the two of them getting tattooed, because like over the course of that decade, like their relationship had changes, and I was kind of stuck in the middle of that, like as like, hi, I'm just the canvas, you know, like, and you two are fighting, what do I do with this? But so had everything else tattooed and was over there in Europe on tour, and tickets were so fucking expensive to get to Europe that I was like, at the end of it, I was like, I should just stay a couple of days. I'm gonna go to Amsterdam. Hit up Gakin, asked if he'd do my tattoo my head. So he said yes, went there and like, you know, shaved my head, fucking drew it on there, tattooed it. And then at the end of the session, he gave me a guitar. I don't have it here, I'd show it to you, but it's like this beautifully hand-painted Gretsch guitar, this intricate swirling design on it. And it really felt like a moment of like, this is the end of the journey together. I've tattooed you from head to toe. Thank you. We won't see each other again, you know? And like, I felt like I learned all these like really like interesting things from the experience that we can talk about some other time. But I took the guitar back to my hotel room, and obviously I'm in Amsterdam, so I'm kind of fucked up. I'm smoking a lot of weed, whatever. And like, it just came out of me instantly, that riff. And everything lyrically is just descriptive of Amsterdam. Like Schiphol is the airport. Rookies is my favorite little like head shop that I'll go and sit and have coffees and smoke weed at. Champagne Haze is my favorite strain. And I was like high as fuck wandering around Vondel Park, and there's like a lot of birds in the trees, and I just thought the birds were like talking to me, you know, like I was that high, or it was like they're obviously saying something to me right now. All the birds talk to, birds talk to. They're out of Champagne Haze and Rookies. I've been gone for weeks and I haven't washed out once yet. Are your wings rose ring? Well, the planes fly a ship or higher than I am. All the birds talk to, they're just having a good life. I've got my mind set on you. Have the beat in the elevator. I take the stairs and I'm coming down. Coming down. Go outside to find myself.
the lyric is go outside and find myself, but originally it was go outside and ground myself. Like people, I had a friend who taught me like that it's important to every once in a while go outside and literally put your feet on the grass, you know, like skin yeah. on earth contact, and like it grounds you, right? And it's good for your body. So it was, you know, I was telling myself to do that in the song, and like, you know, literally came down in the elevator and George Harrison's Got My Mind Set on You was playing. And also Dancing With Myself was playing, and that was originally part of the lyrics too. It was like, I got my mind set on you, heard the beat in the elevator. I take the stairs and I'm coming down, coming down. Go out dancing with myself. Or like I was trying to work the yeah. Billy Idol song in there, and I was like, nah, it's a little too heavy-handed, but yeah.
It feels like, as you describe that, it's so beautiful because that song feels that way. It feels so like just bopping along like with such immediacy. The riff feels that way, and the yeah, I love hearing the what those references are in the song, because I was like, I don't know what this song is really talking about, but
well, like, and it was funny, the Red Hot Chili Peppers line. So I was sitting at Rookies, the head shop, right? And usually playing in Rookies is like, you know, like some kind of no vocal, like type music or whatever, like very yeah. European. And there's like the bud tender, for lack of a better term. She's like sitting there talking to these three dudes, like a really heated conversation in Dutch. So I can't understand what they're talking about, but she's like almost yelling at them. And all of a sudden the fucking Red Hot Chili Peppers come on the radio, and she like stops mid-sentence, turns around and fucking changes the station to like back to something with the oons, oons, oons. What's the name of this song? Places like this, all the birds talk too. They just got much better things to say. Fuck yeah, fuck the Red Hot Chili.
There was a phase of my life that no band could get me to like hit the little like say different button on my car radio than the Red Hot Chili Peppers. I think I've kind of passed that now. I mean,
I honestly like some of their songs. Scar Tissue's great. Fucking like Soul to Squeeze is a brilliant song.
Very brilliant. I think it's
a great guitar player.
I think it's a handful of those like mid 2000s funk ones. Like if they go funk mode in like Blood Sugar Sex Magik, all right, but like the bum, bum, dun, 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 that one is yeah. amazing. That's amazing.
All the dancing and shit.
Yeah. Don't need that. But do you have to, if you interpolate or whatever the word is for like that little like brief moment of a George Harrison song, do you have to like, can that be like low key just in the song, or do you have to like, how does that work? Because George Harrison wrote Tax Man, bitching about his taxes and stuff. Like, yeah. Is the George Harrison state?
I think it's a quote, you know, like in the lyrics, it's a quote. So if right. you're quoting somebody, that's different, you know, like then like, and I'm not trying to deny it, you know, like I'm quoting that.
It's there. Yeah.
I got my mind set on you. I heard the beat in the elevator. How else do you say that? You know?
Hell yeah. So then we have Dysphoria Hoodie. Like what is it about? I know my own, like, which is a different than what the song is, but there's a comfort in a long held like threadbare piece of clothing. It's in particular a hoodie. What is it? What can you just talk a little bit about that song? I found it's relatable to me, even though it's not about a thing that's my experience, you know?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I wrote that song, like, it was effortless as well. And it's very like autobiographical, and you know, like I'm here now wearing an Adidas hoodie, right?
You certainly are.
I find, you know, it's funny, like before a tour, I'll usually like stress about packing, and I'll pack like a bunch of shirts and a bunch of pairs of like, you know, pants or slacks or whatever. And like, then I'll go on tour and I'll wear the same pair of jeans and the same shirt the whole fucking time. And I'll usually wear the same hoodie. And similarly, when I'm home, I like get into that habit of just like being in my hoodie, and it's comfortable. And I like to have, like, you know, when I'm out in public, having the hood, if I need to go like incognito mode, like that's yeah. crucial, right? So it's just like a de facto uniform. But a lot of that is like dysphoria related too, and that like, you know, hides your body. And like, I don't know, like most of the time, like, yeah, I don't like to think about gender, you know, like I don't want to think about gender, especially anymore. I'm so fucking burnt out about thinking about gender and stuff, you know. And I know I've like talked a lot about it in the press and stuff like that, because it's part of my story, and like it was important to come out with it and stuff. But like, that's so far from my thoughts most days, is like, I just don't want to have a gender. I just want to fucking be a hoodie, you know.
Dysphoria hoodie, please do swallow me. Dysphoria hoodie, please do swallow me. When your ends are all threadbare, no better feeling. On a Saturday morning with weed and coffee, A feeling of safety is blanketing me. Your arms of protection are wrapped around me. When it says Adidas on my chest, all day
I think it was in the piece that came out around the album talking about you. It was describing you backstage eating Lay's potato chips, something you heard from Billy Corgan. Can you,
I saw it. I went with my kid to see Smashing Pumpkins at the United Center here in Chicago. And like, he would walk over onto the side of the stage and there's some kind of stand with like, chips on it. And like, he'd eat a chip and very theatrically, help it down his gullet and chew it very finely and then take a sip and then he'd go out and do the next song. And then I forget where I looked more into it and learned that it's like just a hack, a vocal hack, and like something about Lay's potato chips, the classic one in particular, like the grease like coats your throat in a way. And I don't know. I feel like at this point I know every single vocal hack, but it works. Like, and I've had it happen where I'll be in the studio and I'll do a lot of vocal takes and my voice will get a little strained. If I just take a second and eat a couple chips, I'm good to go again.
No shit. That's so cool. Yeah. Cause I'd put Billy Corgan as like a leading contender for like quack science type thing. But at the same time, I want to try that too. Sounds amazing. Did you always care? Like, I think something about it's still in your voice, but like some of the appeal and charm was like, you sounded like a person who was just shredding their voice apart. Like the sound of it is like, this person's not going to be able to sing anymore. Was there care for your voice happening behind that? Or did that come later?
That came later for the exact reasons that you just said, Like the way I sang at first, especially like on Reinventing Axl Rose, like, as I said, we recorded that in 48 hours because we recorded the album twice because we recorded it too fast the first time. But like, that wasn't sustainable. I couldn't have done 7 days in a studio screaming like that. My approach was just to like scream your head off. And then as we started touring more and more, and like, I think back to it first, we would play like 9 song sets starting off, like maybe 20 minutes, 25 minutes. And it's easy to scream your head off like when you're doing that. But then all of a sudden you're on tour for 10 months out of the year. And like, then you're in the studio and you have to sing every day for a month straight and there's pressure and you realize you don't know how you're doing what you're doing and you got to actually fucking get a hold of it. I blew out my voice while recording Searching, and looking back on it now, I know that really what was going on is I was just drinking too much fucking coffee and like the fucking caffeine was stripping my vocal cords because I was like nervous and stressed and just smoking cigarettes and fucking drinking coffee and it was stripping my vocal cords. Yeah.
You drink a fair amount of coffee, right? Are you taking like espresso shots or what's?
Yeah. It's the espresso shots. I like start my day with that quad shot. I need that quad shot. I'm fully addicted. And I took last year, I took like 6-7 months away from caffeine and I slipped up where I had some green tea, like a sip of green tea on a long drive coming back from a tour. I was just exhausted and it hit me like crack. I was so fucking wired. And then I've been just chasing the dragon ever since. But yeah.
Nice.
It's like my one true vice. Like I still smoke weed and stuff, but like coffee, caffeine. And it is not good for my throat, nor is the smoking weed. But when I'm on tour, I'll just do edibles and stuff.
Nice. And I might've listened to you on Jeremy Bohm's podcast. You talked about going to the movies often. Have you gone to the movies lately?
Not lately. I feel like nothing good comes out anymore,
In general or...
Yeah, just like, what the fuck? What is even out? There's no fucking good movies coming out. There's nothing I'm interested in seeing anymore. I don't know. Yeah, I think the last thing I saw was my wife and I went and saw the Priscilla movie, maybe it was.
How was it?
We enjoyed it, but I think I just enjoyed my time with them mostly.
Yeah, I love it. So what's the case where leading into like pre-pandemic, you had played some with Against Me and then that pandemic kind of like halted that?
It's hard to talk about it like with where Against Me's at now, other than we're 3 shows into a tour right in March of 2020 and everything went down where it was clear like we had to cancel and we had tours booked. We were supposed to go out with Baroness and there was other stuff in the works too, so everyone went their separate ways and we are in this weird spot. We had just hired on new management. We had hired on Linda Perry as a manager and it was weird because I'm like, it's fucking Linda Perry, and like immediately they're like telling me to live stream a bunch. And I'm like, I don't fucking want to live stream. And like, I don't know, we weren't communicating well. And I could tell James was really, really burnt out. And people weren't really vibing on the songs that I had been writing, you know? And Andrew and I weren't getting along that great. And so it just kind of like broke it, you know, to where like we just stopped talking. And so, you know, but I had worked my ass off and I had like, you know, 30 some odd songs where I was like, fuck, I don't want to throw away all these songs. So I developed the plan where I went in and recorded them and that became Stay Alive or whatever. But there's full on recordings of all those songs with Against Me, with Everybone playing them.
Did and you have a Patreon and you'll what feels to me like journaling almost in that every once in a while and then releasing old songs. Like you just have a hard drives of old songs and that's how you're choosing what to put out there.
Yeah, and I'm starting to get scared at this point because like, you know, every time I move, you know, shit gets fucked up or shit gets lost or like, you know, cassette tapes especially are only getting older, you know, and like I've been trying to get that original four track that I made all this stuff with Against Me on, for Against Me on, like fixed. But like I'm realizing that if I don't do stuff with certain things, it's just going to be lost, you know, like whether it's because the hard drives will no longer interface with computers because they're old, you know, or whatever, or they'll just crash. And I would rather just, instead of like waiting, just like put it out there, just get it out, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. You don't have to answer this, but what's the, there's been mentioned by Paris, your wife, about being in touch with those band members and stuff like that some more in like recent months and stuff. Is that true?
Yeah, you know, well, I invited everyone to our wedding, right? And like that opened up lines of communication. And, you know, James and Andrew were gonna come and then shit came up. They couldn't make it. Warren actually came to my wedding and like Warren and I hung out and reconciled and it was really cool. And Warren and I have been texting. But, you know, like the basic sentiment between me and James was just like, this is stupid. I love you. You know, like, let's just play music again. So, I don't know what it'll look like and I don't know when it'll happen, but it'll happen, you know, and like that was the whole thing is that's why we didn't break up because we knew that we just needed some space. And I think that's reasonable after like 25 fucking years of going with something, you know, to have it stop with such a like, you know, an event that's out of your control, you know, like what would have happened if the pandemic hadn't have happened? I don't know. We would have put out a record, probably wouldn't have been our best record. You know, like, so we'll just see, you know.
It's very reasonable. Well, cool. Anything else you feel like you'd want to add before I let you go on with your day?
Thank you for giving a shit. I appreciate it. Thank you for the interest. Thank you for being into what I do and listening to stuff, you know.
Every day, how's a beginning and ending like
big thank you again to Laura. That was exciting for me. Her new record is called Hole in My Head. It's great, and it's available now on Polyvinyl and on streaming. A little bit of housekeeping stuff as we button up season 3 of this series. If you listened to the whole thing, you should consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts so that it's not just a bunch of people talking about how much they love Jackson Browne, which is currently the status of that review section. It's all positive, but could use a little diversity. This show is made entirely by me, Justin Cox, and if you'd like to support it and get some extra stuff, you can go to patreon.com/afterthedeluge. I'll be using that space in the coming weeks and months ahead to share what's going to come next in this feed, along with a few more Against Me odds and ends that we've already recorded and some stuff that I'm going to write. And I want to thank all of the patrons who did support it this season really quick. Your zine is incoming. You are Scotty, Hunter, Greg Q, Ian, Hope, Sam, Dan, Arcane Anarchist, Jason, Dennis, Michael, Neil, Thatcher, Travis, Ali, John, Bianca with a K, Donald, Mike, Hound Dog, VM178, Brooke, Your Little Drummer Boy, Creation, Aaron, Kyle, Nick, Taylor, Dave, Ty, Colin, Michael, Veronica, Adam, Jamie, Alex, L. Castine, Tracy, Michael, Mitchell, Greg, Justin, John, Jamie, Justin, Kristen, A. Rains 555, Brian with a Y, Jan Michael, Susan, Bill, and some others that are just combinations of letters and numbers. I see you and I thank you. You can reach me at delugepodcast@gmail.com. Thanks again to Laura. What a cool way to end this thing. Thank you.
It was nice to believe.